Chapter 17. My finest student? A young man, physically perfect. To look upon him was to see a duelist by any known measure. His discipline was a source of awe. His form was elegance personified. He could snuff a dozen candles in successive lunges, each lunge identical to the one preceding it. He could spear a buzzing fly. Within 2 years I could do nothing more for him, for he had passed my own skill. I was, alas, not there to witness his first duel, but it was described to me in detail. For all his talent, his perfection of form, for all his precision, his muscle memory, he revealed one and only one flaw. He was incapable of fighting a real person. A foe of middling skill can be profoundly dangerous, in that clumsiness can surprise, ill preparation can confound brilliant skills of defence. The very unpredictability of a real opponent in a life and death struggle served my finest student with a final lesson. It is said the duel lasted a dozen heartbeats. From that day forward, my philosophy of instruction changed. Form is all very well, repetition ever essential, but actual blood-touch practice must begin within the first week of instruction. To be a duelist, one must duel. The hardest thing to teach is how to survive. Trevan Alt, 2nd century, Darujistan. Gather close, and let us speak of nasty little shits. Oh, come now, we are no strangers to the vicious demons in placid disguises, innocent eyes so wide, hidden minds so dark. Does evil exist? Is it a force, some deadly possession that slips into the unwary? Is it a thing separate and thus subject to accusation and blame, distinct from the one it has used? Does it flit from soul to soul, weaving its diabolical scheme in all the unseen places, snarling into knots tremulous fears and appalling opportunity, stark terrors and brutal self-interest? Or is the dread word nothing more than a quaint and oh-so-convenient encapsulation of all those traits distinctly lacking moral context, a sweeping generalization embracing all things depraved and breathtakingly cruel, a word to define that peculiar glint in the eye, the voyeur to one's own delivery of horror, of pain and anguish and impossible grief? Give the demon crimson scales, slashing talons, tentacles and dripping poison, 3 eyes and 6 slithering tongues. As it crouches there in the soul, its latest abode in an eternal succession of abodes, may every god kneel in prayer. But really, evil is nothing but a word, an objectification where no objectification is necessary. Cast aside this notion of some external agency as the source of inconceivable inhumanity. The sad truth is, our possession of an innate proclivity towards indifference, towards deliberate denial of mercy, towards disengaging all that is moral within us. But if that is too dire, let's call it evil, and paint it with fire and venom. There are extremities of behaviour that seem, at the time, perfectly natural, indeed reasonable. They are arrived at suddenly, or so it might seem. But if one looks, the progression reveals itself step by step, and that is a most sad truth. Murillo walked from the dueling school, rapier at his hip, gloves tucked into his belt. Had he passed anyone who knew him, they might be forgiven for not at first recognizing him, given his expression. The lines of his face were drawn deep, his frown a clench, as if the mind behind it was in torment, sick of itself. He looked older, harder. He looked to be a man in dread of his own thoughts, a man haunted by an unexpected reflection in a lead window, a silvered mirror, flinching back from his own face, the eyes that met themselves with defiance. Only a fool would have stepped directly into this man's path. In his wake, a young student hesitated. He had been about to call out a greeting to his instructor, but he had seen Murillo's expression, and, though young, the student was no fool. Instead, he set out after the man. Belam Nom would not sit in any god's lap. Mark him. Mark him well. There had been fervent, breathless discussion. Crippled Dar was like a man reborn. finding unexpected reserves of strength to lift himself into the rickety cart, with Merla, her eyes bright, fussing over him until even he slapped her hands away. Mew and Hinty stared wide-eyed, brainless as toddlers were, faces like sponges sucking in everything and understanding none of it. As for Snell, oh, it was ridiculous, all this excitement. His Ma and Da were, he well knew, complete idiots, too stupid to succeed in life, too thick to realize it. They had tortured themselves and each other over the loss of Harlow, their mutual failure, their hand-in-hand incompetence that made them hated even as they wallowed in endless self-pity. Ridiculous, pathetic. The sooner Snell was rid of them, the better, and at that thought he eyed his siblings once again. If Ma and Da just vanished, why, he could sell them both and make good coin. They weren't fit for much else. Let someone else wipe their stinking backsides and shove food into their mouths. Damned things choked half the time and spat it out the other half and burst into tears at the lightest poke. But his disgust was proving a thin crust, cracking as terror seethed beneath, the terror born of remote possibilities. Da and Ma were going to a temple, a new temple, one devoted to a god as broken and useless as Bedek himself. The high priest, who called himself a prophet, was even more crippled. Nothing worked below his arms, and half his face sagged, and the eye on that side had just dried up since the lids couldn't close, and now it looked like a rotten crabapple. Snell had seen it for himself when he'd stood at the side of the street watching as the prophet was being carried by his diseased followers to the next square, where he'd croak out yet another sermon predicting the end of the world and how only the sick and the stupid would survive. No wonder Da was so eager. He'd found his god at last, one in his own image, and that was usually the way, wasn't it? People don't change to suit their god, they change their god to suit them. Da and Ma were on their way to the temple of the crippled god, where they hoped to speak to the prophet himself, where they hoped to ask the god's blessing, where they hoped to discover what had happened to Harlow. Snell didn't believe anything would come of that, but then he couldn't be sure, could he? And that was what was scaring him. What if the crippled god knew about what Snell had done? What if the prophet prayed to it and was told the truth, and then told Da and Ma? Snell might have to run away, but he'd take Hinty and Mew with him, selling them off to get some coin, which he'd need and need bad. Let someone else wipe their stinking...
Yes, Ma, I'll take care of them. You two go, see what you can find out.
Just look at them, so filled with hope, so stupid with the idea that something else will solve all their problems, swipe away their miseries. The crippled god. How good can a god be if it's crippled, if it can't even heal itself? That prophet was getting big crowds, plenty of useless people in the world, so that was no surprise, and they all wanted sympathy. Well, Snell's family deserved sympathy, and maybe some coin, too. And a new house, all the food they could eat and all the beer they could drink. In fact, they deserved maids and servants and people who would think for them and do everything that needed doing. Snell stepped outside to watch Ma wheeling Da off down the alley, clickety-click. Behind him, Hinty was snuffling, probably getting ready to start bawling since Ma was out of sight and that didn't happen often. Well, he'd just have to shut the brat up. A good squeeze to the chest and she'd just pass out and things would get quiet again. Maybe do that to both of them. Make it easier wrapping them up in some kind of sling, easier to carry in case he decided to run. Hinty started crying. Snell spun round and the runt looked at him and her crying turned into shrieks.
Yes, Hinty, Snell said, grinning. I'm coming for you. I'm coming for you.
And so he did. Bellum Nom had known that something was wrong, terribly so. The atmosphere in the school was sour, almost toxic, hardly conducive to learning about dueling, about everything one needed to know about staying alive in a contest of blades. On a personal, purely selfish level, all this was frustrating. But one would have to be an insensitive bastard to get caught up in that kind of thinking. The problem was, something had broken Stony Menakis, broken her utterly. And that in turn had left Murillo shattered because he loved her, No doubt about that, since he wouldn't have hung around if he didn't, not with the way she was treating him and everyone else, but especially him. It hadn't been easy working out what was wrong, since nobody was talking much, but he'd made a point of lingering, standing in shadows as if doing little more than cooling himself off after a bell's worth of footwork in the sunlight. And Belumnom had sharp ears. He also had a natural talent, one it seemed he had always possessed. He could read lips. This had proved useful, of course. People had a hard time keeping secrets from Belum. Master Murillo had reached some sort of decision, and walked as one driven now, and Belum quickly realized that he did not need to employ any stealth while trailing him. An entire legion of Crimson Guard could be marching on the man's heels and he wouldn't know it. Belum was not certain what role he might be able to play in whatever was coming. The only thing that mattered to him was that he be there when the time came. Mark him well. These are the thoughts of courage, unquestioning and uncompromising, and this is how heroes come to be. Small ones, big ones, all kinds. When drama arrives, they are there. Look about. See for yourself. He seemed such an innocuous man, so aptly named, and there was nothing in this modest office that might betray humble measures' ambitions, nor his bloodthirsty eagerness in making use of Seba Krafar and his guild of assassins. Harmless then, and yet Seba found himself sweating beneath his nondescript clothes. True, he disliked appearing in public, particularly in the light of day, but that unease barely registered when in the presence of the Master Ironmonger.
It's simple. I don't like the man. And is that surprising? Despite the fact that he's provided the biggest contract I've seen, at least as head of the guild. Probably the Malazan offer Vulcan took on was bigger, but only because achieving it was impossible, even for that uncanny bitch.
Seba's dislike was perhaps suspect, even to his own mind, since it was caught up in the grisly disaster of Humble Measure's contract. Hard to separate this man from the scores of assassins butchered in the effort, still unsuccessful, to kill those damned Malazans. And this particular subject was one that would not quite depart, despite Humble Measure's casual dismissive wave of one soft hand.
"The failing is, of course, temporary," Seba Krafar said. "Hadn't we best complete it to our mutual satisfaction before taking on this new contract of yours?"
"I have reconsidered the Karul Temple issue, at least for the moment," said Humble Measure. "Do not fear. I am happy to add to the original deposit commensurate with the removal of two of the subjects, and should the others each fall in turn, you will, of course, be immediately rewarded. As the central focus, however, I would be pleased if you concentrated on the new one."
Seba Krafar was never able to meet anyone's gaze for very long. He knew that most would see that as a weakness, or as proof that Seba could not be trusted, but he always made a point of ensuring that what he had to say was never evasive. This blunt honesty, combined with the shying eyes, clearly unbalanced people, and that was fine with Seba. Now, if only it worked on this man.
"This new one," he ventured, "is political."
"Your specialty, I gather," said Humble Measure.
"Yes, but one that grows increasingly problematic. The noble class has learned to protect itself. Assassinations are not as easy as they once were."
The ironmonger's brows lifted.
"Are you asking for more money?"
"Actually, no. It's this. The guild is wounded. I've had to promote a dozen snipes months ahead of their time. They're not ready. All they can kill as efficiently as anyone, but most of them are little more than ambitious thugs. Normally, I would cull them ruthlessly, but at the moment I can't afford to."
"This will require, I assume, certain modifications to your normal tactics."
"It already has. 15 of my dead from Karul's bar were my latest promotions. That left the rest of them rattled. An assassin without confidence is next to useless."
Humble Measure nodded. Plan well and execute with precision, Master Krafar, and that confidence will return.
Even that won't be enough unless we succeed.
Agreed.
Sebo was silent for a moment, still sweating, still uneasy.
Before I accept this latest contract, he said, I should offer you a way out. There are other, less bloody ways of getting elected to the council. It seems money is not a problem, and given that...
He stopped when the man lifted a hand. Suddenly there was something new in Humble Measure's eyes, something Sebo had not seen before, and it left him chilled.
If it was my desire to buy my way onto the council, Master Krafar, I would not have summoned you here. That should be obvious.
Yes, I suppose.
But I have summoned you, yes? Therefore, it is reasonable to assume my desires are rather more complicated than simply gaining a seat on the council.
You want this particular councillor dead?
Humble Measure acknowledged this with a brief closing of his eyes that somehow conveyed a nod without his having to move his head.
We are not negotiating my reasons, since they are none of your business and have no relevance to the task itself. Now, you will assault this particular estate, and you will kill the councillor and everyone else, down to the scullery maid and the terrier employed to kill rats.
Sebo Krafar looked away, but then he'd been doing that on and off ever since he'd sat down.
As you say, should be simple, but then these things never are.
Are you saying that you're not up to this?
No, I'm saying that I have learned to accept that nothing is simple, and the simpler it looks, the more complicated it probably is. Therefore, this will need careful planning. I trust you are not under any pressure to get on to the council in a hurry. There are all kinds of steps needed in any case. Sponsorships or bloodline claims, assessment of finances and so on.
He fell silent after, in a brief glance, he noted the man's level look. Sebo cleared his throat and then said,
10 days at the minimum. Acceptable?
Acceptable.
Then we're done here.
We are.
The deposition provided us by the Malazan Embassy is unacceptable.
Councillor Cole fixed a steady regard on Hannot Orr's smooth-shaven face and saw nothing in it but what he had always seen. Fear, contempt, misdirection and outright deceit, the gathered forces of hatred and spite.
So you stated, he replied. But as you can see, the meeting has finished. I do my best to leave matters of the council in the chamber. Politicking is a habit that can fast run away with you, Councillor. I do not recall seeking your advice. No, just my allegiance. Of the two, you elected the wrong one, Councillor.
I think not, since it is the only relevant one.
Yes, Cole smiled. I understood you well enough. Now, if you will excuse me...
Their explanation for why they needed to expand the embassy is flimsy. Are you so easily duped, Councillor Cole? Or is it just a matter of filling your purse to buy your vote?
Either you are offering to bribe me, Councillor Orr, or you are suggesting that I have been bribed. The former seems most unlikely. Thus, it must be the latter. And since we happen to be standing in the corridor with others nearby, close enough to hear you, you leave me no choice but to seek censure.
Hannot Orr sneered.
Censure? Is that the coward's way of avoiding an actual duel?
I accept that it is such a rare occurrence that you probably know little about it. Very well. For the benefit of your defence, allow me to explain.
A dozen or more councillors had now gathered and were listening, expressions appropriately grave. Cole continued.
I hereby accept your accusation as a formal charge. The procedure now is the engagement of an independent committee that will begin investigating. Of course, said investigation is most thorough, and will involve the detailed auditing of both of our financial affairs. Yes, accuser and accused. Such examination inevitably propagates so that all manner of personal information comes to light. Once all pertinent information is assembled, my own advocates will review your file to determine whether a countercharge is appropriate. At this point, the council judiciary takes over proceedings.
Hanut Orr had gone somewhat pale. Call observed him with raised brows.
Shall I now seek censure, Councillor?
I was not suggesting you were taking bribes, Councillor Call, and I apologize if my carelessness led to such an interpretation.
I see. Were you then offering me one?
Of course not.
Then is our politicking done here?
Hanut Orr managed the stiff bow and then whirled off, trailed after a moment by Chardon Lim and then, with studied casualness, young Gorlas Vidicus. Col watched them depart. Estrasian Dahl moved to his side and, taking him by the arm, led him towards a private alcove, the ones designed precisely for extra-chamber politicking. Two servants delivered chilled white wine and then quickly departed.
"That was close," Estrasian murmured.
"He's young and stupid. A family trait, possibly."
"There was no bribe, was there?"
Col frowned.
"Not as such. The official reasons given are just as Orr claimed, flimsy."
"Yes, and he was not privy to the unofficial ones."
"No, wrong committee."
"Hardly an accident. That ambitious trio's been given places on every meaningless committee we can think of, but that's not keeping them busy enough, it seems. They still find time to get in our way."
"One day," said Col, "they will indeed be as dangerous as they think they are."
Outside the building, standing in the bright sun, the three ambitious young councillors formed a sort of island in a sea of milling pigeons. None took note of the cooing on all sides.
"I'll have that bastard's head one day," said Hanut Orr, "on a spike outside my gate."
"You were careless," said Chardon Lim, doing little to disguise his contempt.
Stung, Orr's gloved hand crept to the grip of his rapier.
"I've had about enough of you, old friend. It's clear you inherited every mewling weakness of your predecessor. I admit I'd hoped for something better."
"Listen to you two," said Gorlas Vidicus. "Bitten by a big dog, so here you are snapping at each other. And why? Because the big dog's too big. If he could see you now..."
Hanut Orr snorted.
"So speaks the man who can't keep his wife on a tight enough leash."
Was the perfect extension of the metaphor deliberate? Who can say? In any case, to the astonishment of both Orr and Lim, Gorlas Vidicus simply smiled, as if appreciative of the riposte. He made a show of brushing dust from his cuffs.
"Well, then, I will leave you to whatever, as I have business that will take me out of the city for the rest of the day." "That ironmonger will never get on the council, Vidicus," Chardon Lim said. "There's no available seat, and that situation's not likely to change any time soon. This partnership of yours will take you nowhere and earn you nothing."
"On the contrary, Chardon, I am getting wealthy. Do you have any idea how essential iron is to this city? Ah, I see that such matters are beneath you both. So be it. As a bonus, I am about to acquire a new property in the city as well. It has been and will continue to be a most rewarding partnership. Good day to you, sirs."
There was no denying Seba Krafar's natural air of brutality. He was a large, bearish man, and though virtually none of the people he pushed past while crossing the markets round knew him for the master of the Assassin's Guild, they nonetheless quickly retreated from any confrontation. And if any might, in their own natural belligerence, consider a bold challenge to this rude oaf, why, a second, more searching glance disavowed them of any such notions. He passed through the press like a heated knife through pig fat, a simile most suited to his opinion of humanity and his place within it. One of the consequences of this attitude, however, was that his derisive regard led to a kind of arrogant carelessness. He took no notice whatsoever of the nondescript figure who fell into his wake. The nearest cellar leading down into the tunnels was at the end of a narrow, straight alley that led to a dead end. The steps to the cellar ran along the back of the last building on the left. The cellar had once served as a storage repository for coal, in the days before the harnessing of gas, back when the notion of poisoning one's own air in the name of brainless convenience seemed reasonable, at least to people displaying their lazy stupidity with smug pride. Now the low-ceilinged chamber squatted empty and sagging beneath three levels of half-rotted tenement rooms in symbolic celebration of modernity. From the shutterless windows, babies cried to the accompaniment of clanking cookware and slurred arguments, sounds as familiar to Sebar Krafar as the rank air of the alley itself. His thoughts were busy enough to justify his abstracted state. Fear warred with greed in a mutual ongoing exchange of masks, which were in fact virtually identical. But never mind that. The game was ubiquitous enough, after all. Before too long, in any case, the two combatants would end up supine with exhaustion. Greed usually won, but carried fear on its back. So much for Sebar Krafar's preoccupations. Even without them, it was unlikely he would have heard the one on his trail, since that one possessed unusual talents of such measure that he was able to move up directly behind the master assassin and reach out with ill intent. A hand closed on Sebar's neck, fingers like contracting claws of iron pressing nerves that obliterated all motor control, yet before the assassin could collapse, as his body wanted to do, he was flung halfway round and thrown up against a grimy stone wall, and held there, moccasined feet dangling. He felt a breath along one cheek and then heard whispered words.
"Pull your watchers off Karol's bar. When I leave here, you will find a small sack at your feet. 5 councils. The contract is now concluded. I am buying it out."
The tip of a knife settled beneath Sebar's right eye.
"I trust 5 councils is sufficient, unless you object."
"No, not at all," gasped Sebar. "The Malazans are safe, at least from the guild. Of course, that just means the client will seek, other means."
"Yes, about your client."
"I cannot."
"No need to, Sebar Krafar. I am well aware of the Master Ironmonger's particular obsession."
"Lucky you,"
Sebar said in a growl. Gods, whoever this was still held him off the ground, and that grip did not waver.
"Because,"
he added, for he was still a brave man,
"I'm not."
"If you were," said the man, "you would not be so eager to take his coin, no matter how much he offered."
"Since you put it that way, perhaps those 5 councils down there could buy him an accident."
"Generous offer, but suicidal on your part. No, I do not hire people to do my dirty work."
Through gritted teeth, feeling was returning to his limbs like sizzling fire, Sebar said,
"So I've gathered."
"We're done here,"
the man said.
"Unless you've other pressing business,"
Sebar managed, and felt a slackening of that grip and, vague beneath his feet, the greasy cobblestones.
"Very well," said the voice. "You've actually managed to impress me, Sebar Krafar. Reach up to that old lantern hook there on your left. You can hold yourself up until the strength returns to your legs. It wouldn't do anything for your already damaged dignity to have you fall now. Stay facing the wall for 10 steady breaths, eyes closed. I don't want to have to change my mind about you."
"First impressions are never easy to live up to," said Sebar, "but I'll do my best."
The hand pulled away, then returned to give his shoulder a gentle pat. He stood, forehead pressed against the wall, eyes closed, and counted 10 slow breaths. Somewhere round the third one, he caught the stench. Oh, more than just muscles let loose below his neck, and now he understood the man's comments on dignity.
"Yes, plopping down on my arse would have been most unpleasant."
Sweat ran down both sides of his face. Glancing straight down, he saw the small bag with its measly 5 coins.
"Shit," he muttered. "I forgot to write him a receipt."
Fisher waited at the mouth of the alley until he saw the master assassin delicately bend down to retrieve the bag. Agreement consummated. The master assassin, he was certain, would bother them no more. As for humble measure, well, that man's downfall would require something considerably more complicated. But there was time. And this is the lesson here, dear friends. Even a man such as Fisher Keltath, for all his formidable, mysterious qualities, was quite capable of grievous errors in judgment. Time, then, to return to Carole's bar. Perhaps Picker had found her way back into that cool flesh that scarcely drew breath. If not, why, Fisher might have to do something about that. Lost souls had a way of getting into trouble. Was this sufficient cause for his own carelessness? Perhaps. Leaving the round and its crowds, he walked into the narrow, shady avenue of the Bullocks, threading between the few hurrying passers-by. At night, this street was notorious for muggings, and indeed, was it not but 2 days ago that the city guard had found yet another battered corpse? There, before those very steps leading to a shop selling square nails, rivets, and wooden frames on which to hang skinned things and other works worthy of display. Even during the day, this track was risky. It was the shadows, you see. And out from one stepped a small, toad-visaged apparition wearing a broad grin that split the very dark, somewhat pocked face, reminding one of a boldly slashed, overripe melon. Seemingly balanced on this creature's head was a bundle of bogut. No, it was hair, in which at least 3 spiders nested.
"You!"
hissed the man, his eyes bright and then shifty, and then bright once more. "None other," said Fisher with the faintest of sighs.
"Of course not."
The head tilted, but the hair did not slide off.
"Another idiot. This city's full of them. None other. What kind of thing to say is that? If some other, why, I'd not have leapt into his path, would I? Best keep this simple."
The head righted itself, spiders adjusting their perches to match.
"I bring word from my brilliant, not all there, master."
A sudden whisper.
"Brilliant. Yes, a word used most advisedly. Still, use it once and we're done with it forever."
He then raised his voice once more.
"When all this is done..."
"Excuse me," cut in Fisher. "When all what is done?"
"This, of course. Foolish Iskaral. Keep it simple. Simpler, even. Listen, dear middling bard, when all this is done, eke out the eel. No, wait. Seek out the eel. Seal? Damn, I had the message memorized and everything. Peek at... eat an eel. Seek and peek the bleak earl. Perk the veal. Deal the prick. Thou hod's breath. What was it again? And I had the gall to call him brilliant. He should have sent Sordico Quam, yes, so I could have followed the glorious rocking ship of her sweet hips."
And he wagged his head side to side, eyes glazing.
"Slib slab, slib slab, oh!"
"Thank you,"
Fisher said as the man began muttering under his breath and pausing every now and then to lick his lips.
For the message. I assure you, I understand."
"Of course you do. You're a man, aren't you? Gods, that a simple casual stride could so reduce one to gibbering worship. Why, who needs gods and goddesses when we have asses like that?"
"Indeed, who? Now, since you have successfully delivered your message from your master, may I proceed on my way?"
"What? Naturally, go away. You're a damned distraction, is what you are."
A tilt of the head, and the bard was indeed on his way once more. The mob outside the newly consecrated Temple of the Fallen One, or the Crippled God, or indeed the name by which most knew it, the Temple of Chains, was thick and strangely rank. More than natural sweat, as might be squeezed out by the mid-morning sun, this was the human rendering of desperation, made even sicklier with obsequious anticipation. Yet the door to the narrow-fronted temple remained shut, evidently barred from within. Offerings were heaped up against it, copper and tin coins, as well as links of chain and the odd clasp and cheap jewellery. Bedeck on his cart and Merla standing before him, gripping the handles, found themselves in the midst of trembling alcoholics, the pox-scarred, the lame, and the deformed, Milky eyes stared, as if cataracts were punishment for having seen too much. All other eyes were filled with beseeching need, the hunger for blessing, for even the passing brush of a twisted hand, if it belonged to the prophet. Misshapen faces lifted up, held fixedly upon that door. Within the press the stink became unbearable, the breath of rotting teeth and consumptive dissolution. From his low perch, Bedek could see nothing but shoulders and the backs of heads. Whimpering, he plucked at his wife's tunic.
Merla! Merla!
The look she turned on him was both savage and small, and with a shock Bedek suddenly saw her, and himself, as meaningless, insignificant, worthless. They were, he realized, no better than anyone else here. Each of them seeking to be singled out, to be guided out, to be raised up from all the others. Each dreaming of coming into glorious focus in the eyes of a god. Eyes brimming with pity and knowledge. Eyes that understood injustice and the unfairness of existence. A god, yes, to make them right.
To make us all, each and every one of us, right, whole.
But Bedek had held no such notions. They were not why he was here. He and Merla were different. From all of these people, they, you see, had lost a child. The door would remain locked, they learned, until at least midday, sometimes even later, and even then the prophet might not emerge. If he was communing with his own pain, they were told, he might not be seen for days. Yes, but did he bless people? Did he help people? Oh, yes. Why, I saw a man in terrible pain, and the prophet took it all away. He healed the man? No, he smothered him, delivered his spirit, now at peace, into the hands of the fallen one. If you are in pain, this is where you can end your life. Only here, do you understand, can you be sure your soul will find a home. There, in the loving heart of the fallen one, don't you want to find your legs again? Other side of life, that's where you'll find them. And so Bedek came to understand that perhaps this crippled god could not help them. Not with finding Harlow, and all at once he wanted to go home. But Merla would have none of that. The yearning was unabated in her eyes, but it had been transformed, and what she sought now had nothing to do with Harlow. Bedek did not know what that new thing might be, but he was frightened down to the core of his soul. Snell struggled to form a sling to take the runts, both of whom were lying senseless on the floor. He had checked to see they were both breathing, since he'd heard that making them black out could sometimes kill them, if he'd held them tight for too long, though he'd been careful. He was always careful when doing that, though if one of them did die, why, he would say it went to sleep and just never woke up, and that happened, didn't it, with the little ones? And then he'd cry, because that was expected. Poor thing, but it had always been weak, hadn't it? So many children were weak. Only the strong ones, the smart ones, survived. It's what the world was like, after all, and the world can't be changed, not one bit. There was a man in the Daru High Market who always dressed well and had plenty of coin, and it was well known he'd take little ones, 10, 20 silver councils, boy or girl, it didn't matter which. He knew people, rich people, he was just the middleman, but you dealt with him if you didn't want no one to find out anything. And if there were any small bodies left over, well, they never ever showed up to start people asking questions. It would be a bit of a walk, especially with both Mew and Hinty, and that's why he needed to work out a sling of some sort, like the ones the Rivi mothers used. Only, how did they do that? The door opened behind him and Snell whirled in sudden terror. The man standing on the threshold was familiar. He'd been with Stoni Menakis the last time she'd visited, and Snell could see at once that dear Snell was in trouble. Ice-cold fear, a mouth impossibly dry, a pounding heart.
They're just sleeping.
The man stared.
What have you done to them, Snell?
Nothing. Go away. Da and Ma aren't here. They went to the Chains Temple. Come back later.
Instead, the man stepped inside. One gloved hand casually flung Snell back, away from the motionless girls on the floor. The blow rocked Snell, and as if a stopper had been jarred loose, fear poured through him. As the man knelt and drew off a glove to set a palm against Mew's forehead, Snell scrabbled to the back wall.
I'm going to call the guards! I'm going to scream!
Shut your damned face or I'll do it for you!
A quick, heavy look.
I've not yet started with you, Snell. Everything comes back to you. On the day Harlow went missing, on that day, Snell...
He lifted his hand and straightened.
Are they drugged? Tell me how you did this.
He meant to keep lying, but all at once he thought that maybe if he told the truth about this, the man might believe the lies he used afterwards on the other stuff.
I just squeeze them when they cry too much, that's all. It don't hurt them none, honest.
The man had glanced at the stretch of burlap lying beside Mew. Maybe he was putting things together, but nothing could be proved, could it? It would be all right. It would be two quick strides in those hands, one gloved and the other bare and scarred, snagged the front of Snell's tunic. He was lifted into the air until his eyes were level with the man's. And Snell saw in those deadly eyes something dark, a lifeless whisper that could flatten out at any moment, and all thoughts of lying whimpered away.
On that day, the man said, you came back with a load of sun-dried dung. Something you'd never done before, and have never done since. No, your mother said it was Harlow who did such things. Harlow, who at 5 fucking years old did more to help this family than you ever have. Who collected that dung, Snell?
Snell had widened his eyes as wide as they could go. He made his chin tremble.
Harlow,
he whispered.
But I never hurt him, I swear it.
Oh, he hadn't wanted to lie. It just came out.
Past Worrytown or Two Ox Gate?
The gate. Two Ox.
Did you go with him or did you follow him? What happened out there, Snell?
And Snell's eyes betrayed him then, a flicker too instinctive to stop in time, down to where Mew and Hinty were lying. The man's eyes flattened just as Snell had feared they might.
I never killed him. He was breathing when I left him. If you kill me, they'll find out. They'll arrest you. You'll go to the gallows. You can't kill me. Don't!
You knocked him out and left him there after stealing the dung he'd collected. The hills beyond Two Ox Gate.
And I went back a couple of days, the day after, and he was gone. He's just run off, that's all.
A 5-year-old boy doing everything he could to help his family just ran off, did he? Or did you drive him off, Snell?
I never did. He was just gone. And that's not my fault, is it? Someone maybe found him, maybe even adopted him.
You are going to tell your parents everything, Snell, the man said. I will be back tonight, probably late, but I will be back. Don't even think of running.
He won't, said a voice from the door. The man turned.
Bellum, what?
Master Murillo, I'll stay here and keep an eye on the fucker. And when his parents show up, well, he'll spill it all out. Go on, Master. You don't need to worry about anything happening back here. The man, Murillo, was silent for a time, seeming to study the rangy boy who stood, arms folded, leaning against the doorway's frame. And then he set Snell down and stepped back.
I won't forget this, Bellum.
It'll be fine, Master. I won't beat the bones out of him, much as I'd like to, and much as he obviously deserves it. No, he's going to sit and play with his little sisters, soon as they come round.
A splash of water should do it.
After a splash, then. And not only is Snell going to play with them, but he's going to make a point of losing every game, every argument. If they want him to stand on his head while picking his asshole, why, that's what Snell will do. Right, Snell? Snell had met older boys just like this one. They had calm eyes, but that was just to fix you good when you weren't expecting nothing. He was more frightened of this Bellum than he'd been of Murillo.
You hurt me and I'll get my friends after you,
he hissed.
My street friends.
And when they hear the name Bellum Nom, they'll cut you loose faster than you can blink. Murillo had found a clay bowl into which he now poured some water.
Master, said Bellum, I can do that. You got what you needed from him. At least a trail, a place to start.
Very well. Until tonight then, Bellum, and thank you.
After he'd left, Bellum shut the door and advanced on Snell, who once more cringed against the back wall.
You said...
We do that, don't we, when it comes to grown-ups?
Don't touch me!
No grown-ups anywhere close, Snell. What do you like to do when they're not around? Oh, yes, that's right. You like to torment everyone smaller than you. That sounds a fun game. I think I'll play. And look, you're smaller than me. Now, what torment shall we do first?
In leaving them for the time being, all grim concern regarding anything unduly cruel can be thankfully dispensed with. Belum Nom, being cleverer than most, knew that true terror belonged not to what did occur, but to what might occur. He was content to encourage Snell's own imagination into the myriad possibilities, which was a delicate and precise form of torture, especially useful in that it left no bruises. Bullies learn nothing when bullied in turn. There are no lessons, no about-face in their squalid natures. The principle of righteous justice is a peculiar domain where propriety and vengeance become confused, almost indistinguishable. The bullied bully is shown but the other side of the same fear he or she has lived with all his or her life. The about-face happens there, on the outside, not the inside. Inside, the bully and everything that haunts the bully's soul remains unchanged. It is an abject truth, but conscience cannot be shoved down the throat. If only it could. Moths were flattened against the walls of the narrow passageway, waiting for something, probably night. As it was a little used route to and from the Vidicus estate, frequented twice a day at specific times by deliveries to the kitchen, Chalice had taken to using it with all the furtive grace of the insouciant adulteress that she had become. The last thing she expected was to almost run into her husband there in the shadows midway through. Even more disconcerting, it was clear that he had been awaiting her, one hand holding his dueling gloves as if about to slap them across her cheek, yet there was an odd smile on his face. "Darling," he said. She halted before him, momentarily struck dumb. It was one thing to play out the game at breakfast, a table between them cluttered with all the false icons of a perfect and perfectly normal marriage. Their language then was such a smooth navigation round all those deadly shoals that it seemed the present was but a template of the future, of years and years of this, not a single wound stung to life, no tragic floundering on the jagged shallows, sailors drowning in the foam. He stood before her now, tall, with a thousand sharp edges entirely blocking her path, his eyes glittering like wrecker fires on a promontory. "So pleased I found you," he said. "I must head out to the mining camp. No doubt you can hear the carriage being readied behind you." Casual words, yet she was startled like a bird. Flash of fluttering, panicked wings in the gloom as she half turned to register the snort of horses and the rustle of traces from the forecourt behind her. "Oh," she managed, then faced him once more. Her heart's rapid beat began slowing down. "Even here," Gorlas said, "there is a sweet flush to your cheeks, dear. Most becoming." She could almost feel the brush of fingertips to grant benediction to the compliment. A moth, startled awake by the clash of currents in the dusty air, wings dry as talc as it fluttered against her face. She flinched back.
"Thank you," she said.
This was just another game, of course. She realized that now. He did not want things to get messy, not here, not any time soon. She told herself this with certainty and hoped it was true. But then, why not an explosive shattering? Freeing him, freeing her, wouldn't that be healthier in the end?
"Unless his idea of freeing himself is to kill me. Such things happen, don't they?"
"I do not expect to be back for at least 3 days, 2 nights."
"I see. Be well on your journey, Gorlas."
"Thank you, darling."
And then, without warning, he stepped close, his free hand grasping her right breast.
"I don't like the thought of strangers doing this," he said, his voice low, that odd smile still there. "I need to picture the face, one I know well. I need a sense of the bastard behind it."
She stared into his eyes and saw only a stranger, calculating, as clinical and cold as a dresser of the dead, like the one who'd come to do what was needed with the corpse of her mother, once the thin veil of sympathy was tossed aside like a soiled cloth and the man set to work.
"When I get back," he continued, "we'll have a talk, one with details. I want to know all about him, Chalice."
She knew that what she said at this precise moment would echo in her husband's mind for virtually every spare moment in the course of the next 3 days and two nights, and by the time he returned, her words would have done their work in transforming him into a broken thing or into a monster. She could say, "All right," as if she was being forced, cornered, and whatever immediate satisfaction he felt would soon twist into something dark, unpleasant, and she would find herself across from a vengeful creature in 3 days' time. She might say, "If you like," and he would hear that as defiance and cruel indifference, as if for her his needs were irrelevant, as if she would oblige out of pity and not much else. No, in truth, she had few choices in what she might utter at this moment. In an instant, as he awaited her response, she decided on what she would say, and when it came out, it was calm and assured, but not too much so.
"Until then, husband."
He nodded, and she saw the pupils of his eyes dilate. She caught his quickened breathing and knew her choice had been the right one. Now, the next 3 days and two nights, Gorlas would be as one on fire, with anticipation, with his imagination unleashed and playing out scenarios, each one a variation on a single theme.
"Yes, Gorlas, we are not done with each other yet, after all."
His hand withdrew from her breast, and, with a courtly bow, he stepped to one side to permit her to pass. She did so. Murillo hired a horse for the day. With tack included, the rental amounted to 3 silver councils along with a 20-council deposit. Of that, the animal was worth perhaps 5, certainly not much more. Slope-backed, at least 10 years old, worn out, beaten down, the misery in the beast's eyes stung Murillo to sympathy, and he was of half a mind to forego the deposit and leave the animal in the hands of a kindly farmer with plenty of spare pasture. He rode at a slow, plodding walk through the crowded streets until he reached Tuok's gate. Passing through the archway's shadow, he collected the horse into a steady trot on the cobbled road, passing laden wagons and carts and the occasional Gadrobi peasant struggling beneath baskets filled with salted fish, flasks of oil, candles, and whatever else they needed to make bearable living in a squalid hut along the roadside. Once beyond the leper colony, he began scanning the lands to either side, seeking the nearest active pasture. A short distance on, he spied sheep and goats wandering the slope of a hillside to his right. A lone shepherd hobbled along the ridge, waving a switch to keep the flies off. Murillo pulled his mount off the road and rode towards him. The old man noticed his approach and halted. He was dressed in rags, but the crook he carried looked new, freshly oiled and polished. His eyes were smeared with cataracts from too many years in the bright sunlight, and he squinted, wary and nervous, as Murillo drew up and settled back in the saddle.
"Hello, good shepherd,"
a terse nod answered him.
"I am looking for someone."
"Nobody but me here," the old man replied, flicking the switch before his face.
"This was a few weeks back. A young boy up here collecting dung, perhaps."
"We get 'em out from the city."
The furtiveness was ill disguised. The old man licked his lips, switched at flies that weren't there. There were secrets here, Murillo realized. He dismounted.
"You know of this one," he said. 5 years old. He was hurt, possibly unconscious."
The shepherd stepped back as he approached, half raised the crook.
"What was I supposed to do?" he demanded. "The ones that come out here, they got nothing. They live in the streets. They sell the dung for a few coppers. I got no help here. We just working for somebody else. We go hungry every winter. What was I supposed to do?"
"Just tell me what happened," said Murillo. "You do that and maybe I'll just walk away, leave you be. But you're a bad liar, old man, and if you try again, I might get angry."
"We wasn't sure he was going to live. He was beat up near dead, sir. Would have died if we hadn't found him, took care of him."
"And then?"
"Sold him off. It's hard enough feeding ourselves."
"To who? Where is he?"
"Iron mines. The Eldra holdings west of here."
Murillo felt a chill grip his heart.
"A 5-year-old boy?"
"Moles, they call him. Or so I heard."
He returned to the horse, lifted himself into the saddle and roughly pulled the beast round, rode hard back to the road. 1,000 paces along, the horse threw a shoe. The ox lumbered along at the pace of a beast for which time was meaningless, and perhaps in this it was wise indeed. Walking beside it, the man with the crop twitched its flank every now and then, but this was habit, not urgency. The load of braided leather was not a particularly onerous burden, and if the carter timed things right, why, he might wangle himself a meal at the camp before the long return journey back to the city. At least by then the day would be mostly done and the air would have cooled. In this heat, neither man nor beast was in any hurry. Hardly surprising, then, that the lone traveller on foot caught up with them before too long, and after a brief conversation, a few words to either side of the jangle of coins, the load on the cart grew heavier, yet still not enough to force a groan from the ox. This was, after all, the task of its life, the very definition of its existence. In truth, it had little memory of ever being free, of ever trundling along without something to drag behind it, or the endless reverberation in its bones as wheels clunked across cobbles, slipping into and out of worn ruts in the stone. Languid blinks, the storm of flies that danced in the heat, twitching tail and spots of blood on the fetlocks, and pulling something from one place to another. And at its side, squinting red-shot eyes, a storm of flies dancing, spots of blood here and there from midges and whatnot, and taking something from one place to another. Ox and driver, parallel lives through meaningless years. A singular variation now, the man sitting with legs dangling off the cart, his boots worn and blisters oozing, and the dark maelstrom in his eyes that was for neither of them, and no business of theirs besides. The ornate, lacquered, leaf-sprung carriage that rumbled past them a league from the camp had its windows shuttered against the heat and dust. The man in the back had watched its approach. The carter watched it pass. The ox saw it moving away in front of it at a steady pace that it could never match, even had it wanted to, which it didn't. Snell was nobody's fool, and when the ball of bound, multicoloured twine rolled close to the door and Hinty stared at it, expecting its miraculous return to her pudgy, grimy hands, why, Snell obliged, and as soon as he was at the door, he darted outside and was gone. He heard Bellum's shout, but Snell had a good head start, and besides, the stupid idiot wouldn't just leave the runts behind, would he? No, Snell had made good his escape, easy as that, because he was clever, and jerks could threaten him all the time, but he won in the end. He always won. Proof of his cleverness. Up the street, into an alley, under the broken fence, across the narrow yard, chickens scattering from his path, and on to the stacked rabbit pens, over the next fence, into Twisty Alley, 20 strides up and then left, into the muddy track where a sewage pipe leaked. Nobody'd go down this pinched passageway, what with the stench and all, but he did, piss soaking through his worn moccasins, and then he was out onto Purse Street and freedom. Better if he'd stolen the runts to sell. Better still if he'd still had his stash of coins. Now he had nothing, but nobody would catch him now. There were some older boys with connections to the gang that worked Worrytown, lifting what they could from the trader wagons that crowded through. If Snell could get out there, he'd be outside the city, wouldn't he? They could hunt forever and not find him. And he could make himself rich. He could rise in the ranks and become a pack leader. People would be scared of him, terrified even. Merchants would pay him just not to rob them. And he'd buy an estate and hire assassins to kill Bellum Nom and Stony Monarchus and Murillo. He'd buy up his parents' debts and make them pay him every month. Wouldn't that be something? It'd be perfect. And his sisters he could pimp out, and eventually he'd have enough money to buy a title of some sort, get on the council and proclaim himself King of Darujistan, and he'd order new gallows built and execute everyone who'd done him wrong. He rushed through the crowds, his thoughts a world away, a future far off but almost in reach. His feet were clipped out from under him, and he fell hard, numbing shock from one shoulder and his hip. Bellum Nom stood over him, breathing hard but grinning. "Nice try," he said.
"Mew and Hinty, you left them!"
"Locked up, yes. That's what slowed me down." And he reached down, grasped Snell's arm, and yanked him to his feet, twisting hard enough to make him yelp in pain. Bellum dragged Snell back the way he'd come.
I'm going to kill you one day,
Snell said, then winced as Bellum's grip tightened on his arm. It's what people like you rely on, isn't it?
What?
That none of us are as nasty as you. That we'll have qualms about, say, skinning you alive, or shattering your kneecaps, gouging out your eyes. You want to kill me? Fine. Just don't be surprised if I get to you first, Snell.
You can't murder.
Can't I? Why not? You seem to think you can, whenever you like, whenever the chance arises. Well, I'm not Stony Menakis. I'm not Murillo either. They're civilized folk. No, Snell, I'm more like you. Only I'm older and better at it.
If you did anything to me, Murillo would have to go after you. Like you say, he's not like us, or Stony. She'd cut you to pieces. Yes, it'd be Stony once Dar asked her to, and he would.
You're making a big assumption, Snell.
What?
That they'd ever figure out it was me.
I'll warn them. As soon as they come back, I'll warn them about you.
Before or after you make your confession. About what you did to poor Harlow.
That was different. I didn't do nothing on purpose.
You hurt him. Probably killed him. And left his body for the birds. You kept it all a secret, Snell. Good knows, if I asked nicely enough, your Da might just hand you over to me and good riddance to you. Snell said nothing. There was true terror inside him now. So much terror it filled him up, spilled out through his pores and out from between his legs. This Bellum was a monster. He didn't feel anything for nobody. He just wanted to hurt Snell. A monster. A vicious demon, yes, a demon. Bellum was everything that was wrong with everything.
I'll be good,
Snell whimpered.
You'll see. I'll make it right, all of it.
But these were lies, and both of them knew it. Snell was what he was, and no amount of cuddling and coddling would change that. He stood there in the mind as if to say, we are in your world, more of us than you imagine. If you knew how many of us there are, you'd be very, very frightened. We are here. Now, what are you going to do with us? Snell was what he was, yes, and so too was Bellum Nom. When he was dragged in through the narrow door of a nondescript shop at the near end of Twisty Alley, Snell suddenly recoiled. He knew this place. He knew...
What you got yourself there, Bellum?
A fresh one, Gorus, and I'll let him go cheap.
Wait!
Snell shrieked, and then a heavy hand clamped over his mouth and he was pulled into the gloom, smelling rank sweat, feeling a breath on his cheek as the ogre named Gorus leaned in close.
A screamer, is he?
A nasty little shit, in fact.
We'll work that out of him.
Not this one. He'd stab his mother just to watch the blood flow. It's probably left a trail of tortured small animals 10 leagues long, buried in little holes in every backyard of the neighbourhood. This is one of those, Gorus.
18 silver?
Slivers?
Yeah.
All right. Snell thrashed about as he was carried off into a back room, then down steps and into an unlit cellar that smelled of piss-soaked mud. He was gagged and bound and thrown into a low iron cage. Gorus then went back up the stairs, leaving Snell alone. In the front room, Gorus sat down across from Bellum.
Ale, nephew?
Too early for me, uncle.
How long you want me to hold him?
Long enough to shit everything out of him. I want him so scared he breaks inside.
Give him a night, then. Enough to run through all his terrors, but not so much he gets numb. Shit, nephew, I don't deal in anybody under, 15 years old. And we do careful interviewing and observing, and only the completely hopeless ones get shipped to the rowing benches. And even then, they get paid and fed and signed out after 5 years, and most of them do good after that.
I doubt Snell knows any of that, uncle. Just that children are dragged into this shop and they don't come back out.
Must look that way.
Bellum smiled. Oh, it does, uncle. It does.
Not seen him in days.
Barathol just nodded, then walked over to the cask of water to wash the grime off his forearms and hands. Charles sat on a crate nearby, eating some local fruit with a yellow skin and pink, fleshy insides. Juice dribbled down his stubbled chin. Silara gave him a bright smile as she wandered into the front room. The air smelled brittle and acrid, the way it does in smithies, and she thought now that from this moment on the scent would accompany her every recollection of Barathol, this large man with the gentle eyes.
"Had any more trouble with the guilds?" she asked.
He dried himself off and flung the cloth to one side.
"They're making it hard, but I expected that. We're surviving."
"So I see."
She kicked at a heap of iron rods.
"New order?"
"Swords. The arrival of the Malazan embassy's garrison has triggered a new fad among the nobles. Imperial longswords. Gave trouble to most of the local swordsmiths."
He shrugged.
"Not me, of course."
Silara settled down in the lone chair and began scraping out her pipe.
"What's so special about Malazan longswords?"
"The very opposite, actually. The local makers haven't quite worked out that they have to reverse engineer to get them right."
"Reverse engineer?"
"The Malazan longsword's basic design and manufacture is originally Untan, from the Imperial mainland. 3 centuries old, at least, maybe older. The Empire still uses the Untan foundries, and they're a conservative bunch."
"Well, if the damned things do what they're supposed to do, why make changes?"
"That seems to be the thinking, yes. The locals have gone mad folding and refolding, trying to capture that rough solidity. But the Untan smiths are in the habit of working iron not hot enough. It's also red iron that they're using. The Untan hills are rotten with it, even though it's rare everywhere else."
He paused, watching as she lit her pipe.
"This can't be of any real interest to you, Silara."
"Not really, but I do like the sound of your voice."
And she looked up at him through the smoke, her eyes half veiled.
"Anyway, I can make decent copies and the word's gone out. Eventually some swordsmith will work things out, but by then I'll have plenty of satisfied customers and even undercutting me won't be too damaging."
"Good,"
she said.
He studied her for a moment and then said, "So, Cutter's gone missing, has he?"
"I don't know about that, only that I've not seen him in a few days."
"Are you worried?"
She thought about it and then thought some more.
"Barathol, that wasn't my reason for visiting you. I wasn't looking for someone to charge in as if Cutter's been kidnapped or something. I'm here because I wanted to see you. I'm lonely. Oh, I don't mean anybody'll do, either, when I say that. I just wanted to see you, that's all."
After a moment, he shrugged and held out his hands.
"Here I am."
"You won't make it easy, will you?"
"Silara, look at me. Please, look. Carefully. You're too fast for me. Cutter, that historian, even that bridge burner, you leave them all spinning in your wake. Given my choice, I'd rather go through the rest of my life beneath the notice of everyone. I'm not interested in drama, or even excitement."
She stretched out her legs.
"And you think I am?"
"It's life that you're full of."
Barathol frowned and then shook his head.
"I'm not very good at saying what I mean, am I?"
"Keep trying."
"You can be overwhelming."
"Typical. Put on a little fat and suddenly I'm too much for him."
"You're not fat and you know it. You have," he hesitated, "shape."